of various stream ciphers, and in particular, this is from the semi-official eStream, that's the Crypt Stream Cipher Project timing suite, although updated a little bit to cover some of the latest ciphers and some of the latest software, including, where was, yes, here we go, grain 128. The numbers that you see on the right here are cycles per byte in various situations, like you have a long stream or a shorter message with more overhead for dealing with the short message, various other measurements. And what's interesting about this grain 128 and grain version 1, also some new software, grain is one of the hardware eStream focus ciphers. Focus phase 2, that it's particularly of interest for its low number of bit operations. There's a low operation count for how much work hardware has to put in to compute grain. Actually, grain 128 is a relatively new submission, which is designed more for software, but let me focus on grain v1, which is the somewhere in this list, the particularly hardware-oriented focus cipher. There we go, grain v1. H exclamation point for the hardware focus. Okay, not quite as few cycles per byte, but anyway, this was selected as something interesting for hardware and not at all interesting for software. And maybe it's something where the low number of bit operations, the apparently good combination of hardware performance and security, is going to convince people to build chips that support grain. And then what happens if somebody needs to talk to those chips using software cryptography? Well, their old grain version 1 reference software, the ref here, was taking thousands of cycles per byte. And just by writing a little bit of code, the central loop of grain is very, very small, very simple, just by writing a little bit of code, they ended up with grain something like 50 times faster. Instead of 2,000 cycles per byte, it's now 40 cycles per byte. And I'm sure there's even more speed-ups possible. It's not going to be one of the leading stream ciphers in software, but it's just a good example of how much benefit you can get by simply tweaking software a little bit. There's really very little code in grain, and the main speed-up here is simply by doing 64-bit operations in parallel rather than doing, say, one-bit operation at a time. Grain is maybe defined in terms of individual bit operations, but you can easily organize those so that many of them are done in parallel, and then you end up with something like a 50 times speedup. And similarly for other machines, this particular one is a 64-bit Intel Core 2 Duo. And there's other machines where similarly the new software achieves, say, a 20 or 30 times speedup. Something else that I peeked at over the lunch break was Rabbit, which in this browser I'm going to have to do a little Google search for. Rabbit contest. I think I understated the prize before. Chasing the Rabbit, a cryptanalytic contest. I said $1,000. It's actually $1,000 US. Here we go. US $1,000 for the most interesting paper on Rabbit cryptanalysis. You don't have to break it. Just like the Salsa 20 competition. If you just get partial results, then well, if it's the most interesting results for the judges, then you get your $1,000. In order to qualify, a paper has to meet the following conditions. At least part of the paper deals with cryptanalysis of Rabbit, cryptanalysis maybe of the full cipher or reduced version, cipher components. You have to have it accepted at a cryptographic conference with proceedings. Cryptographic conferences tend to like cryptanalysis papers, especially of things that people have heard of, like Rabbit. And then you have to notify them, and the closing date is September 30th, 2007, so lots of time, but you should get your submission in early in case somebody else comes up with the same cryptanalysis. So those of you who like doing cryptanalysis, you can give Rabbit a try. That's the one I mentioned before, is using some multiplications and XORing together the high bits and low bits. Okay, I have a few more comments on stream ciphers. Namely, I wanted to say something about side channel attacks, and then finally jumping into Diffie-Hellman. So what is there to say about side channel attacks? Well, I think of lots of software bugs as side channel attacks. Cryptography is trying to scramble information so that you can't see it, and a side channel attack is when you accidentally just give somebody the information or something that's closely related to the information that you're trying to keep secret. For me, this dictates how software should be written. I see side channel attacks as another reason to avoid something that before I was saying, you should avoid, at least I don't like it because I don't think it provides good security for its speed, but you should also avoid, what was I talking about, selection and S-box lookups. The general feature here, what to watch out for, is doing a load of an array at a secret index, x bracket I, loading that with a secret I. And the reason is, let me first describe this theoretically and then try to convince you that it's a serious reason. The time for loading the x bracket I, the time to get back the result, the time for the load, and for subsequent instructions after the load, relying on the results or just delayed by the load for whatever reason, and the time for the total computation of whatever cipher you're in, or any other cryptographic computation, anything working with a secret I, and even for other programs on the same machine. If you have a multi-user machine, then lots of programs are running at the same time, and the CPU works on one and then stops after a while and works on another, and the time for doing a load or the state of the cache after a load, all these can depend on I. To complete the sentence here, the time for any of these things, and including for other programs on the same machine, all of these depend on I. They're functions of I, not the constant function. For a reason that you're familiar with, namely when you load something, then it could be in cache, or maybe not. Even if it is in cache, the time is variable on some processors for reasons I haven't talked about. You have to look carefully at the machine description to see exactly how fast the load is. So the time depends on I, and maybe an attacker can see that time and therefore see I. And maybe that's a problem. Maybe I is your secret key, or maybe it's something that lets the attacker figure out your secret key. Now, there's a whole lot of maybes here. This all sounds quite speculative, but this really does work. If you look at, for example, a paper by Osvik and Shamir and Tromer in 2005, then they wrote a little program that ran at the same time as other programs on the same machine. They were running a program on the attackable machine, which is realistic. This is something where you log into somebody else's computer and run a program. And they used that program to find an entire AES key. And what AES key was this? What was it being used for? Well, it was somebody else's AES key, specifically the Linux disk encryptor. Through what's called a hyper-threading attack. A hyper-threading attack relies on, to some extent, your machine being a hyper-threading machine, as many current computers are. When you run several programs, then the machine can bounce very, very quickly between the programs. That's what hyper-threading does. Specifically, if one program is sitting there waiting for a load, then that's enough time for another program to run. That's what hyper-threading does. It's a very fast way to bounce between processes. And that also creates a big interaction between the time for one process's loads and the time for the operations in other programs that are running on the same CPU. And this was such a big interaction that they were able, just by asking the Linux disk encryptor to write some blocks, which any user is allowed to do, just save some blocks to disk, the users aren't supposed to know the key, which is protecting all the other users' data as well, but in 65 milliseconds, something like 800 disk writes, all consecutive, they were able to figure out the AES key of the disk encryption. So this is not just some theoretical concern. This is something that really revealed critical secret data that if any users had had their data protected by that disk encryption on that other machine, okay, it was actually a laboratory machine, but could be carried out on any multi-user machine with the same AES software and with hyper-threading. So what does this tell us about cipher design? What does it say about AES? Well, let me emphasize that the attack here is not something considered in the attack model. When I was describing what it is that a stream cipher is supposed to do, SALSA-20 is conjectured to have its outputs indistinguishable from uniform random strings. Well, our security requirements, that definition of a good stream cipher, used the output of the cipher. The attacker was given access to the output, but was not allowed to peek over the shoulder of the cipher computation, as in fact you can very frequently do. It ignored the timings of the cipher. The formal definition of cipher security, according to indistinguishability, the way that I outlined, is something that just says, all right, the attacker issues a request, and he gets back the, for instance, an authenticator, or he tries forging a message and sees what happens, but he doesn't have any information aside from here's the encrypted string, here is the yes or no, did your attack succeed. There's a very limited interface to the attacker, which is actually not what happens in the real world. In the real world, the attacker can see timings, and in this case, on the same machine, and in other cases in the literature, even attacking other machines, you can extract information from timing and other side channels. In the case of AES, well, the AES output seems secure. You can't figure out the AES key or any other pattern from the AES output. But the AES timings, which I should emphasize are a function of the software you use, the AES software timings for basically every AES program that people use, these are not secure. These leak the key. Maybe I should say that's what I mean here, how disastrously insecure these are. These leak your secret key. Now, you can stop this type of attack. And one way to do it is say, okay, I said before that I don't like all the time you're spending on loads, but the alternatives of trying to do bid operations to compute, use additions and XORs, for example, they can compute the same X bracket I, but that doesn't mean you want to because it's really slow. Well, you could just do that, and it's really slow. It avoids loads. It doesn't put your secret information, your I, onto the address bus of your computer, which is what leaks it to an attacker. Without such a massive slowdown, you can still stop these attacks. You can eliminate the leak, eliminate this software bug, without massive slowdown. Roughly, what you have to ensure is that X bracket I, all of the X bracket anythings, are in cache, which actually is harder than it sounds. You can't just load them because maybe your program gets interrupted after you've loaded them, and by the time it gets back, the X bracket I's have been knocked out of cache again. Maybe some of your own loads and stores inside your AES computation, whatever computation you're doing, maybe those knock the other things that you have in cache, maybe it knocks some of them out of cache. Maybe even if everything is in cache, the time is variable. You really have to look at your CPU documentation. To avoid interrupts, you need support from the operating system. And to avoid all the other effects that I've been briefly mentioning, like even loads from cache take different amounts of time depending on I, you really need some careful programming, which depends a lot on your CPU. For instance, there's just for dealing with the Athlon load timings, had to do a huge amount of programming, which depends very much on undocumented features of the Athlon. And then combined with OS support, I think that I've gotten all the Athlon AES software running in constant time, but it's still, I wouldn't be sure without going carefully through the Athlon documentation that doesn't exist. If you want details on how to do this sort of thing and what seems to be required to make X bracket I fast and avoid these timing leaks and other similar like hyperthreading leaks, then I have a paper with several sections of, okay, here's what you can do for AES as a typical example. I don't like doing this. Even though, if you just look at the results, it seems that it can be done. The effort to do it is sufficiently high that nobody has actually done the complete picture. I think I've gotten the CPU-specific programming for several CPUs for AES, but I've not seen any operating systems with the necessary support. It's always possible in every AES software that I've seen that does loads of X-bracket-I, which is every fast AES implementation out there, it is always possible to extract the key from timings. Maybe the engineering costs in the long term won't be an obstacle. Maybe people will actually deploy secure AES software, but it still depends on details of your CPU, and every time there's a new CPU, there's a new question of, okay, exactly how long do your loads take? How long do your stores take? And are there any weird interactions depending on the secret index, I? This is extremely fragile. Which doesn't mean that it can't be done, but it's not my preferred style of cryptographic design. I like things that are simple, secure, and high speed, and all the desired features seem to be achieved by simply avoiding S-boxes, avoiding this particular instruction, which again doesn't seem to actually make ciphers faster. AES is not a stellar example of the speed of a cipher, and there are lots of other examples of ciphers that don't use this instruction. TEA is maybe too small, low security level, small block size, not really suitable for serious cryptography, but it's still an inspirational example. Helix is another example. Bouncing back in time, Serpent, one of the AES finalists, along with Rheindahl, which was selected. And there's lots of other ciphers. Helix is a predecessor to Felix, which is one of the leading eStream candidates. I think if NIST, selecting the advanced encryption standard, had not screwed up in various clear ways, they would have selected Serpent rather than Rheindahl. I say this with no affiliation with the Serpent designers, aside from, well, I think their work is better than Rheindahl, but, well, anyway, Rheindahl was selected, and it has these cache timing attack problems, whereas Serpent does not. So, let me summarize one last stream cipher slide here. Stream cipher recap. I gave SALSA 20 as an example of the state of the art, and I certainly feel quite confident that it is secure. It is conjecturally, quite reasonable conjecture, that it is secure. But it's by no means unique. There are lots and lots and lots of examples. You can easily write down your own favorite functions, and there are tons and tons of alternatives. Pretty much anything you can imagine computing, just compute it, and it's probably going to be a secure stream cipher. You should avoid some simple mistakes. There are a few clearly bad ideas. You should not have, say, something linear. And you should not have something that just diffuses bits from left to right and not from right to left. There are all sorts of, well, I went through the critical things you can do wrong, and everybody agrees that those are things you can do wrong. And then there's lots of other variations which don't do those things wrong, and they seem just fine. Tons and tons of computable functions that are good stream ciphers. There are some things that are controversial, things like the S-box issue. S-boxes are extremely popular. And if you exclude S-boxes, then you are excluding quite a lot of the ciphers that people have written down, although there's certainly many left. But even if you do that, even if you throw away the things people agree are bad and the things that I say are bad and the community does not yet have full agreement on all those, even if you throw all those away, you're still left with tons and tons and tons of ciphers. There are still many remaining ciphers that all seem just fine. So So lots of good alternatives there, and I just want the fastest thing out there, and I don't know, maybe SALSA 20 is the best that we have for speed security trade-off, maybe it's not. There's still more analysis that's going on within eStream, and we'll see what people like in a few years. I also want to stick in at this point a few comments on other alternatives that I haven't mentioned. Namely, you can have alternatives to the authenticated encryption that I've described. I've said, put together a stream cipher, plug it into our provably secure authentication. But I briefly mentioned in the authentication context that there were other ways to authenticate things. You don't have to put together something provably secure for your message authentication plus a stream cipher. For example, there's HMAC, there's CBC. HMAC is a way to use, say, MD5 as a message authentication code. CBC is a message authentication code, maybe the most popular one out there. CBC can also be used for encryption. Most of these things I could write down, particularly HMAC and CBC, these are fairly slow and they don't have any particularly attractive security features, but you can imagine that within the broader space of alternatives to the type of authenticated encryption I've described, maybe there's some combined system that achieves better results. Like Felix has the interesting feature of doing both authentication and encryption in one combined operation, which is maybe faster than what you can do any other way. Or maybe it's not. It's not clear how much benefit you can get by integrating these operations. It's certainly a slowdown if you look at denial of service. If you don't want to decrypt forged packets, then Felix is clearly a loss, but maybe for typical non-denial of service cases, maybe it's a win. All right, lots of ideas there for secret key cryptography, which finally brings me to public key cryptography, which is actually a lot easier as a topic because there's a lot fewer functions out there. We need functions that satisfy some amazingly restrictive properties. Before I do that, maybe I'll say last chance for questions about stream ciphers. Yeah?
So the difference in the timing when you're accessing an array, is it because of the fact that certain elements are not in the cache, or is it just has to do with how you calculate the index?
There are two levels of issues. So calculating the index is usually not a problem. The uncached elements of the array X are certainly a problem. That's the first level of issue, and there's lots of reasons that things don't end up in cache, and it's not nearly as easy to put things into cache and guarantee that they stay there as you might hope. And then the more subtle issue is that even if things are in cache, then the timing for your load varies. For instance, on the Athlon, the Athlon can load two 32-bit chunks in one cycle. Very convenient for AES, because AES has a ton of loads. Except, if the I and J, if you're loading X bracket I and X bracket J in the same cycle, and I and J satisfy some condition mod 64, like they're in the same 8 bytes of your cache line, then the Athlon will delay the second load for a cycle, which also ends up having interesting effects on the time for the rest of your computation. And this is detectable. This is something, even remotely, you can detect this timing if you do enough samples of your total AES time, and my cache timing paper goes through an example of detecting this kind of tiny effect even through a network. So that's a case where everything's in cache, but your load timing still depends on your secret indices. And the way that I worked around that one was saying, okay, figure out exactly when the Athlon will be doing its loads and make sure that the instructions are set up so that there's exactly one load on each cycle, which might slow things down a little bit, but not a huge penalty compared to not using loads at all, and it does seem to stop the timing attacks. Anyway, if you want more information, I have a cache timing paper that goes through, there's a problem, here's a worked example of an attack, and here's how we can try, like 7 sections on trying to avoid the problem without giving up loads entirely. And then I have a more recent talk that I gave in Louvain-la-Neuve about cache timing, where I try to survey, here's what the critical problems are, and directly answer questions like that, like, is it a problem of the cache, or is it a problem of things not in cache, or is it a problem of things that are in cache and still have different timings, and what are the different types of attacks, how do we protect against those attacks, and trying to articulate research directions for people who want to study these attacks further. For me, as a designer, I don't want to get into something simply because it's a fun research area. It's an intriguing question of how much information you can deduce from the time taken by cryptographic software. If I'm talking to a user, I don't want to tell the user, hey, this is a fun, interesting question of how much information we're leaking, and hopefully it's not going to be 65 milliseconds to for an attacker to steal your AES key. I want to tell the user, okay, there are no timing attacks here. We are using constant time instructions. We are staying away from things like secret branches, secret index array lookups. And we're making sure that our cryptographic software takes time which doesn't depend in any way on the input. Does that answer your question? Okay. Do you have a question? Yeah. Okay. Yeah, question is, if you have a really small table, the extreme example, for instance, yeah, if you're computing exponentiations of any sort, elliptic curves or otherwise, you might have a table of x0 through x15, or even just x0 and x1. And what I do this afternoon, we'll have a couple of different inputs, which depending on just one bit, you want to select one of those inputs. And, well, can you extract information in that case? There's a paper by Colin Percival. Actually, several groups all figured out how serious this problem was about the same time, and he was one of them and said, hey, wait a minute, I can extract information from OpenSSL, which was doing, I think, a one-bit table lookup, but I don't remember the details. I also don't know whether that attack was based more on the load timings or on other aspects of how OpenSSL was accessing memory. I know it was based on hyper-threading and looking at OpenSSL's effects on other programs running on the computer. It certainly obtained information from the effects that OpenSSL was having on a very small table, even if I don't remember the exact size of the table. So there's certainly a potential problem even for tiny little tables. Maybe OpenSSL was suffering in that case because its table consisted of something that didn't fit inside a cache line. It was something like a few elements of a big field, and in that case, it's well, unlikely for that to fit into 64 bytes, a typical cache line size. You can go to a lot more, you can much more easily guarantee that a single cache line stays in cache and that its timings are independent of the index you use, rather than going across multiple cache lines. So maybe if X is very small, then these issues are easier to deal with. But again, for me, I don't want to be thinking about these things in designing cryptographic software, especially if I can get the best speeds of anything without using any of these dangerous instructions, like loading with a secret index. Is that answering your question? Maybe. Okay, so the quick summary is, yes, there's potentially a problem. It seems like a smaller problem in the sense of it should be easier to fix than the typical cache timing problem or hyper-threading problem or other types of attacks along these lines. But I don't recommend designing things that way. There's, as we'll see in the context of elliptic curve Diffie-Hellman, the way that I'm going to be doing it, the state-of-the-art functions have just a small percentage slowdown for completely avoiding these secret index array lookups. And when it's so easy to avoid using secret indices, then I just don't see the point. You might as well get the best speed and completely avoid these issues. From an engineering perspective, it's clearly better to spend less time worrying about these than to try to work around the issues in some other way. Okay, more questions about stream ciphers? I think it's time for public key cryptography. So, Diffie-Hellman is the critical idea. In public key cryptography, and it's also major course topic number 3. What do you do with Diffie-Hellman? This is eliminating the requirement of secrecy from the old channel. Somehow, using a public channel, with no shared secrets that let you view it as the new channel that you're somehow protecting with, say, poly 1305, no shared secrets. The sender and receiver are going to build a new shared secret. Something that really does seem secret. A new shared secret. Which is a wonderful, magical idea. Great idea of Diffie and Hellman. This removes the requirement for, again, the old channel to be secret. Well, I'll draw the picture in a moment. I'm going to give you a specific function and then consider alternatives. As usual, I'm going to define curve 25519. Same function considered on the web pages where I've been going through some UltraSpark software engineering examples. I'm going to define this curve 25519 function. It's an example of an elliptic curve Diffie-Hellman function. And somehow applying this function a few times is going to allow the sender and receiver to make a secret out of no secrets to begin with. We're going to use this function to compute. It's going to take some time to compute. I'll be more precise about that in a little while. Use it to compute a new short shared secret K. And then this K is going to be combined with the salsa 20 expansion of K and with the poly 1305 and one-time pad protection of messages against forgery and against eavesdropping. Here, first of all, is the revised channel conversion. We have a sender and a receiver with, I'm going to, for simplicity, assume a two-way channel. The sender and receiver are each exchanging information. Here, this channel has to provide authenticity, but it does not have to provide secrecy. What's being transmitted each way through this old channel is a 32-byte public key. I should put public key in quotes. The sender generates a public key, sends it to the receiver. The receiver generates a public key, sends it to the sender. Each one of those is 32 bytes. What are they? I'll get to that in a moment. There's one of these being transmitted each way, and that is the old channel. If you have the old channel, then, through the magic of Diffie-Hellman plus the secret key stuff that I've been talking about, you create a new channel which protects any number of messages, providing authenticity and secrecy, and it's new. The new channel, conjecturally, provides secrecy and provides authenticity for messages from the sender to the receiver, and you can, of course, repeat the picture from the receiver back to the sender. Any number of messages, M1, M2, etc., same types of messages as before. These are up to 16 LN bytes, where L is the length of each message in terms of number of chunks, number of 16-byte chunks for poly 1305, and N is the number of messages, which can be gigantic. L can be big for secret key authentication, N can be big thanks to the stream cipher, and at the beginning, the old channel compared to the new channel, again, aside from the conjecture, we're doing drastic improvements here, much more bandwidth, adding secrecy, and moving security forward in time. All right, what does the sender-receiver exchange look like? Well, there's some curve 25519 function, which is applied to, first of all, the sender's secret number. Sender has a 32-byte secret, which I'm going to call E, thinking exponent. And the receiver generates his own 32-byte secret. Now, these secrets are not shared. The protocol starts with each party just doing his own thing. No initial K or R or S that these people are sharing. They both feed their numbers independently through curve 25519, producing the sender's public key from the sender's secret key. Sender's public key is curve 25519 applied to E. And the receiver feeds F through the same function, which everybody knows, and comes up with the receiver's public key, curve 25519 of F. And those are the public keys that are exchanged through the old channel. The sender sends the public key to the receiver. Receiver sends receiver's public key to the sender. And then starting from the secret E and the receiver's public key, I should be doing a line, maybe be better around the outside, not squish so much, but starting from the sender's secret E and the receiver's public key, curve 25519 of F, the sender invokes curve 25519 again. It actually has two inputs. There's curve 25519 applied to E and curve 25519 of F. The receiver does the same thing with the secret F and the sender's public key, curve 25519 of E. Exactly the same computation. Curve has 25519 as part of the function name. Inside the function, we have F, comma, the sender's public key, curve 25519 of E. And now the amazing magic of Diffie-Hellman functions, in particular elliptic curve Diffie-Hellman functions, in particular this one, well, all of the Diffie-Hellman functions out there satisfy this property, is that these are equal. They're both equal to curve 25519 of the product, E times F. E and F are integers here. Obviously, this equation drastically restricts the functions we can write down. Functions of two arguments that have this amazing kind of associativity, some sort of group action here that we've got, or semi-group action that we've got, E applied to the application to F gives us E times F applied to the whatever the input is. And this is a property that, well, you certainly, it's nothing at all like the secret key cipher design problem, that we have to have a special function that satisfies these properties. Now, assuming that we do, what do we do with it? Well, let me first go through, where am I in my notes here? Before I show you the connection to salsa 20 and so on, and be careful about what K looks like in this picture, let me emphasize the cost. The sender is, through all time, going to compute just one public key. And maybe people will tell you sometimes, okay, you should regenerate your public key every year. But it's a negligible cost, because the sender can reuse the public key with any number of receivers. Sender reuses public key with many receivers. And similarly, the receiver reuses his public key with many senders. As a consequence of this, we're not worried about the initial public key computation time. We will ignore the cost of computing E mapping to curve 25519 of E. What we are worried about is what happens for every receiver. The sender's major cost, and this is something that every time the sender wants to set up a new channel with a new receiver, the sender's major cost, this is for each receiver, once for each receiver, is to take the receiver's public key and the sender's secret key, E, and starting from those two inputs, E and some X that the sender doesn't know, different for each receiver, computing curve 25519 of those two inputs. And that's the bottleneck that I'll focus on the speed of. There are various improvements. The single input function you can just do with the two input function, where X is a particular input, 9 is the particular input, so that curve 25519 of E is curve 25519 of E, 9. But you don't have to worry about the cost of doing that, you just say, well, it happens so rarely that we just don't care. Whereas the number of receivers you talk to, that can be quite large. One sender can be talking to many, many receivers, a server, a bank website, talking to lots and lots of users. There can be all sorts of sender-receiver channels, and each one of those needs this curve 25519 of two inputs computation. Having said that, there are some speedups in the single input computation. I'm just not going to cover them at all because I don't care about those speedups. All right. What does the sender do with the curve 25519? Well, the sender can simply declare that that shared secret, well, the shared curve 25519 of E times F, that is the K. Sender now knows K, which is curve 25519 of E times F, which again is curve 25519 of, to repeat in case the font's a little too small there, the magic equation here is that this is the same as applying curve 25519 to two inputs, one of them being the receiver's public key. People will often write down a more complicated expression for K, because this K doesn't look maybe quite random enough. That's one reason. For instance, curve 25519 actually produces just 255 bits of output. It'll be a result mod 2 to the 255 minus 19, and that doesn't have the last bit being set. So, whoops, we have only 255 bits in the key K. Maybe there's some more structure because of how curve 25519 is defined that people might conceivably worry about. And there's another issue, which is that you want to distinguish the public key for this channel from the new channel from the sender to the receiver from one that you would build from the receiver to the sender, which you could do by being careful about who's sending to whom, or you could just concatenate the public keys. Let me put in parentheses, a typical tweak is to hash this K, where I'm going to be deliberately vague about what hash is, but take this K that I've shown you and replace it with the hash of it and the two public keys. Sender, comma, receiver, public keys. Whether or not you use a tweak like that for various reasons, it's a low-cost tweak to do, no reason really not to do it aside from writing the software. Certainly, yeah, I can recommend doing this. It'll make everybody happy, whereas the alternative doesn't, but it's independent of everything else I say. Once you have this K that's shared by the sender and receiver, both of them compute it, then you turn it into R, S1, S2, and so on, using expand K, using your favorite stream cipher, which, okay, for some of you might not be salsa 20, but for me, salsa 20 is a favorite, expand it into R, S1, S2, T's, all the usual R's that have been featured throughout the course for protecting information against forgery and against eavesdropping when you have the T's, and then combine this in exactly the same way with poly 1305. Is this secure? Well, conjecturally it is. Let me state carefully the security conjecture. Fortunately, I can fit that into the bottom here. The conjecture is that this protocol adequately simulates the protocol we had that we believed before was secure. Without curve 25519, we just made a shared secret K somehow that they share through the old channel. And then they expand it and combine it, and we think that's secure. Well, is this a good simulation of that? And the conjecture says it is. The conjecture says that the attacker, given the public keys, can't distinguish this K from the previous protocol, can't distinguish K from a uniform random string, can't, I'll just say distinguish K, implicitly distinguish it from uniform random. If that's true, if the attacker can't tell the difference between this shared secret and a uniform random string, and okay, obviously if this 255 versus 256 bit issue isn't handled, if you don't tweak it, then the conjecture becomes unreasonable because the attacker says, ha-ha, the top bit of K is always a zero. Okay, you have to throw in the tweaks at some point to make people happy, but assuming you have the tweaks, the reasonable conjecture is that the attacker cannot tell the difference between this curve 25519 of E times F and a uniform random string, even if the attacker knows curve 25519 of E and curve 25519 of F, as the attacker certainly does. They're public. The attacker is watching the old channel. There's no requirement of secrecy there. I failed to label in my picture the bottom equation here, this magic equation. What makes Diffie-Hellman functions much more restricted than general functions like stream ciphers? How do we produce this magic? Well, in case anybody hasn't seen Diffie-Hellman before, let me briefly give you the oversimplified, the original Diffie-Hellman system. And let me mention that this is not exactly curve 25519, but it's something similar. Let's call it old 25519. Just to make you believe that functions can satisfy this kind of equation, let's define old of E is 9 to the power E mod 2 to the 255 minus 19. And more generally, let's define old 25519 of E comma X as X to the E mod 2 to the 255 minus 19. One of the obvious speed-ups if you have a 9 for X is to say, hey, multiplying by 9 is easier than multiplying by X, but most of your work should be squarings anyway. Anyway, I'm not going to worry about the speed of the single input. What we care about is a random X coming in, somebody else's public key, and then take its E's power. And this certainly does satisfy the magic equation. The magic is certainly true that if you want to get your shared secret, if you want to compute 9 to the EF, product of E and F, mod, that's prime, 2 to the 255 minus 19, well, even if it weren't prime, it would certainly be true that this is, what are we doing here? If we have old 25519 of F, that's 9 to the F, mod 2 to the 255 minus 19, and then compute its eth power, mod 2 to the 255 minus 19 again, and yes, that's the same. The inner mod disappears. 9 to the F to the E is 9 to the EF. Yay, so we have our magic equation. The only problem with this system is that it is surprisingly easy to break. In the Diffie-Hellman question, the critical question was, okay, we've looked at it, several people have looked at it, but we don't know. Is it secure? We think it is because nobody's come up with an attack. Question? Well, following the historical development, the question back in the Diffie-Hellman days was, is it secure? And what I'm about to say is, yes, actually, it is breakable. No, it is not secure. This is a quantitative question. In my classification earlier today of mathematical problems, I had some problems like integer factorization that are sort of surprisingly easy, although not polynomial time as far as we know. And this is another of those problems, very similar complexity to integer factorization. There's a class of techniques for undoing this 9 to the E mod a prime, index calculus. Specifically, the latest and greatest index calculus algorithms are all variations of the number field sieve. For about 15 years, we've known how to compute a discrete logarithm, computing 9 to the e mod any prime, q, getting e out of that, assuming E is in a limited range, so there's just a unique E, or finding some E that works, which is good enough to distinguish Diffie-Hellman, we can compute E from 9 to the E mod Q, and the number of bit operations is conjecturally rather small, and also if you measure the price-performance ratio, then it's conjecturally, and lots of experiments confirm this conjecture, something we strongly believe in, the number of bit operations, okay, let's just do it, it's exponential of, inside the exponential is everything else I'm going to write, which starts with a factor of 1.976 dot dot dot, some complicated real number, plus little o of 1, something that converges to 0. So the parenthesized quantity here, still going on the formula, is something that converges to a certain number, which is very close to 1.976, converges as q goes to infinity. More to the formula, there is log, log base 2? No. There's log natural log of q to the 1/3 power. And then there is a log log q, natural log of the natural log of q to the 2/3 power. Finally, that's closed parenthesis. Ignoring the 1.976, e to the 1.976, all right, some number like 5 or so. 5 to the power of cube root of log q, 2/3 power of log log q. This is the number of dollar seconds, your price performance ratio. The little o of 1, what converges to 0, is convergence as q gets bigger and bigger. The conjecture, if you try plugging in a particular value of q, then you have to know more about what the little o of 1 is. Don't just assume the little o of 1 is 0, it's not. But it is something that as q gets bigger and bigger, then throwing away the little o of 1 gives you less and less of an error in the relative exponent. As a practical matter, you try these methods for q equals 2 to the 255 minus 19, and let me just say, for every q less than 2 to the 512, this is doable. And we can imagine even going up to 2 to the 1024 with massive computation. It's scaling as, well, some weird function, what I've shown here, that as q gets bigger and bigger, if you were to double the number of bits in q, then you take this log q, if q changes to q squared-ish, or prime around q squared, then log q doubles. And so the 1/3 root of it gets multiplied by something. So the runtime gets taken to maybe the 1.4 power if q doubles in the number of bits. And that's a pretty big increase. Every time you double, taking a power of the time of this attack is increasing it more and more. But, well, okay, it's scaling as this 1/3 root of log q in the exponent. Okay, there's the function. You can draw graphs of it for yourself. You can also turn this function around. Something I like to do with these runtimes is say, okay, I just want to know, for say, 128 bits of security, my usual comfortable security level, what do I need q to be? So let's work backwards, invert this function, and say that we have 2 to the b dollar seconds, the price performance ratio of the attack, the number of dollars spent by the attacker times the number of seconds spent by the attacker. If that's supposed to be 2 to the b, then what does q need to be? Well, just solve this equals 2 to the b, and you end up with some constant times what you need is that q grows as some constant, well, some bounded quantity, times b cubed divided by the square of log b. And you can work out the constant. It's actually a pretty small constant, something like 1/50th, but is 50 right? What I'm thinking, you can go through the calculations yourself and work out, keeping track of the natural log versus the log base 2, work out what this constant is, and as concrete matters, figure out for various q's, all right, how hard is this? Fairly easy. It's something like, if q has 512 bits, it's something like 2 to the 60 operations, 2 to the 70 operations, depending on exactly how you measure your costs. You might get different ideas of how the scaling works, but everything ends up saying that as the number of bits of security gets bigger and bigger, your q has to grow quite dramatically as the cube of the number of bits of security. And then everything you do mod q, if that takes, say, at least linear time as q grows, that's at least cubic in your security level. So this is not a situation where we want to just casually double the number of bits of security and expand q by, say, 8 or 7 in the number of bits of q. That's going to dramatically slow down our computation, even if we have really fast computation mod Q, we're going to have at least linear scaling in Q of the computation time, which means at least cubic scaling in B. Again, the formula is B cubed over the log of B squared. And that log, well, ignoring that, it's basically B cubed. All right, so index calculus slows down the original Diffie-Hellman system by requiring Q to be pretty big. Elliptic curve Diffie-Hellman, what Miller and Koblitz suggested in the mid-80s, is better because it's faster. I'll talk about alternatives after I've done curve 25519, but just to say, summarize what it is that curve 25519 does, uses a more complicated function, mod the same prime, 2 to the 255 minus 19, but a different group law. More complicated function is noticeably slower, something like an order of magnitude slower. Pretty serious slowdown. Several times slower. But it has the virtue of avoiding index calculus. As far as we know, there's no way to apply index calculus or any of the other attacks that people know of to curve 25519 better than, well, I'll tell you what the best attack is and tell you why we have a 255-bit security level, but first let me give you a definition of curve 25519. Curve 25519 of E is, let's see, it is the x-coordinate of the eth multiple of, let me just pause for a moment and remind you that before we were computing eth powers, and here we're computing eth multiples, which might seem like it's even less cryptographically secure, but, well, that's just a notational difference. The group here is actually more complicated than, much more complicated than powering, the eth multiple of the point 9, comma, dot, 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 same base point 9, on the elliptic curve y squared equals x cubed plus 486662 x squared plus x modulo 2 to the 255 minus 19, in other words, over z mod 2 to the 255 minus 19. Okay, lots and lots of words there, which I have to define, but there is, if you know the standard words, there is the definition of the curve 25519 function, at least for one input, and then for two inputs, well, instead of starting with 9 comma something, you start with the second input comma something. Same definition. Curve 25519 of E times F can be determined in a way I will explain from curve 25519 of F and E, or from curve 25519 of E and F by exactly the magic equations here, which I'm going to show you. All right, what else is there to say preliminarily about curve 25519? I want to tell you the fastest attack we know, and then the fastest computation we know, and then I can tell you the definition. Was I hearing a potential question from? Yeah. 9, comma, dot, dot, dot. Well, okay, what that means is either of the points on this elliptic curve that has x-coordinate 9. There are two solutions to y squared equals x cubed plus blah, 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 when x is equal to 9. Take either one of those, multiply by e using the elliptic curve group law, and then take the x-coordinate. You get a result independent of the point you started with, and that is the curve 25519 output of e. But I will be going through the definition carefully just as soon as I've done the performance features of curve 25519. Let me say, if there are further questions about the definition, please hold them until I've given the careful definition of what this elliptic curve is. Are there other questions about what curve 25519 or elliptic curve Diffie-Hellman generally is doing for us? Okay, critical performance constraints. There is how fast are the best known attacks and how fast are the computations. The fastest attack that we know is called parallel Pollard row method, or a parallelized row. There's a variant, the kangaroo method, which is a little easier to play with in lots of situations and maybe twice as slow. So Pollard has these methods of computing discrete logarithms, and this isn't just an attack that distinguishes the shared secret from a uniform random string. Among all the attacks we have that distinguish, the fastest thing we know is just go ahead and compute E from curve 25519. This computes, starting from the x-coordinate of the eth multiple, starting from the eth multiple of a point on this elliptic curve, it gives you back what the multiple was. Using approximately 2 to the 128 curve operations, where maybe I should say that the curve operations are not as complicated as a complete curve 25519 computation. They're only a fraction, let's say a thousandth of a curve 25519 computation, but still something pretty serious, not just a single bit operation. That's a large number of bit operations to carry out. Before, we were contemplating a rich attacker who maybe could do 2 to the 90 salsa 20s. And, okay, he's probably not going to be able to do 2 to the 128 curve operations. But on the other hand, we were a little scared of 128-bit security in the secret key context. Let me go through some of the issues here. First of all, what if the attacker has only a fraction as much time to spend? Let's say he gets up to 2 to the 100 curve operations. Is he going to be able to compute this function? And, well, this attack really doesn't have a chance of succeeding before the typical time. The probability of finishing sooner drops quadratically with the sooner. The probability of finishing much sooner is negligible. So if the attacker wants to succeed at least 1% of the time, then he needs to go to at least 1/10 of this number of operations, not 1/100. And if he wants to succeed at least a millionth of the time, he has to go to 1/1000 of 2 to the 128 curve operations. If he only has, say, 2 to the 90 curve operations he can do, he only has a 2 to the minus 76 chance of success, approximately, maybe 2 to the minus 75. Another thing that was a concern in the secret key stream cipher context was doing multiple target attacks. If there's a billion users, then you can save a factor of 2 to the 30. You're going to break some user's key a billion times sooner than you would expect for a single user. There is a multiple target version of Pollard Row, something that does a million discrete logs in only 1,000 times as many curve operations. But if you're trying to finish sooner, then multiple targets don't help. The first target is not going to be done any sooner than this 2 to the 128. The second target, once you've done one of these computations, which I'm saying is extremely hard to do, probability of the attacker doing it is negligible. If he does one, then he can do others a little faster. And the speed up increases with the number of users. But the chance of him finishing anything after, say, 2 to the 90 or 2 to the 100 curve operations is negligible. So multiple targets don't help here in the same way that they did for stream ciphers. And based on this, I feel comfortable with the security level of curve 25519. All of the speeds scale in a certain way with the security level. You can consider smaller security levels. I always find myself at the high end of security levels people are thinking about. Right now, the industry standard for elliptic curves is 2 to the 80 operations, 160-bit elliptic curves. And those are somewhat faster, let's say twice as fast for the users, which I'm about to get to. But they provide a lot less security. I feel much less comfortable at 2 to the 80. I think that's a doable number of operations, whereas 2 to the 128 is a lot more operations, and that's not something I imagine an attacker doing anytime in the near future. Maybe if quantum computers are built, then all these systems will be broken, but that's a separate issue. I don't anticipate 2 to the 128 operations. If someone is worried about this and wants an even higher security level, then, okay, you can scale things up. Depending on the security level you're comfortable with, well, there's some scaling for how fast the computations are. Here I've chosen a level that for many years, I imagine that I and everybody else is going to be happy with. Again, right now the industry standard is even smaller, and you can of course gain speed if you have a smaller security level. Okay, what does this function look like from the user's perspective? How long does it take to compute curve 25519? Well, I have a list with several chips on it, and let me just quickly show you the list. This is not my complete list, but just a sample of machine variability here. Let me start with the low end of the number of cycles. The Athlon takes 600,000 cycles, 624786 cycles. The Pentium M is pretty close to competitive, taking 640838 cycles. The Pentium 3, which is a lot like the Pentium M, but a few more bottlenecks, and that actually noticeably slows down the software, 832457 cycles. And the Pentium 4 takes 957, only a little below a million cycles for this computation. And then what I've been putting on the web page is my new UltraSpark implementation, which is in progress. The lower bound I have for what the UltraSpark could conceivably do in the way that I've been writing the software is something over 400,000 cycles. The current software, with no attempts at scheduling the instructions properly, takes 2 million cycles. I imagine that in the end, the UltraSpark will be somewhere in the middle here, maybe 800 or 900,000 cycles, maybe better. Hopefully it can get down a lot closer to the 400,000 lower bound, but for the moment, the software is taking a couple million cycles, and I'll have more discussion of this on the webpage. Okay. In any case, this is all done with the usual floating point tricks. I'll say more about the details after I've given the high-level description of these, how these computations work, which also requires that I define the function. I have this awful feeling that I'm leaving something out. Ah, yes. Always important when somebody tells you speeds to put them in context and say, does any user actually care about these speeds? Suppose that you are, as a sender and receiver, transmitting L bytes of data and authenticating them with, say, Poly 1305, and then maybe encrypting them with SALSA 20, or maybe just using SALSA 20 for generating R's and S's, in which case you don't really care about its speed. Something like 5 cycles for Poly 1305, 10, 15 for SALSA 20, overall maybe 20 cycles per byte, 20 times L bytes, compared to the half a million, a million cycles that curve 25519 is taking. Is that an issue? Well, it depends on L. And here applications really vary. There's tons of applications where you are transmitting a lot of data from the sender to the receiver. L is megabytes or more, and in that case, you're just not going to notice the time to do the curve 25519 computation. It's so fast that, well, you just don't care about the speed. If, on the other hand, you're transmitting only a few kilobytes of data between some users, then the bottleneck is very much the Diffie-Hellman computation, the curve 25519 computation. And in that case, it's really important to squeeze these down as much as possible, because these are repeated, well, your total time is repeating this curve 25519 computation, half a million or a million cycles, for each user you're talking to. You can only do that, say, a few thousand times a second, depending how fast your CPU is, versus, okay, for every byte you communicate to all the users, and then a little overhead for each message, for every byte you're communicating, you have to do something that's a few cycles, as many as 20 cycles maybe, per byte. And if you're transmitting a lot of bytes, that's more important. So it depends on your application, how much you care about the curve 25519 speed. There are many alternatives to the system, but I'm going to defer the discussion of those and how fast or how slow they are until after I've given you the curve 25519 definition and talked about the computation. I think since I have 20 minutes, I can fit the definition of, which fortunately I copied the important formulas out of the original sources, so I can give you the curve 25519 definition, and then that should be enough for today. Curve 25519 formulas. All right, let me start with the field over which curve 25519 is working. let's define K to be the field I mentioned before, Z mod 2 to the 255 minus 19. This is a set 0, 1, 2, 3 through 2 to the 255 minus 20. Adjoin a square root of 2. What I mean by adjoin a square root of 2 is you consider polynomials, a plus b root 2, where a and b are both integers mod 2 to the 255 minus 19. You add and multiply those in the way you would expect. B root 2 times another root 2 is 2b. And then, you work with these polynomials. Formally, it's the polynomial ring over z mod 2 to the 255 minus 19 mod x squared minus 2. Whenever you see, if you have an a plus bx times a c plus dx, you replace the x squared by 2. And that forms ring operations. And this ring turns out to be a field because 2 is not a square mod 2 to the 255 minus 19. If you like, feel free to replace K by an algebraic closure of K. You can take any field that has square roots of all the elements of Z mod 2 to the 255 minus 19, and that will give you the same definition of curve 25519 in a few minutes. All right, over this K, I'm going to define E of K as one unified object. Really, I should be defining E, but I just care about E evaluated at K. For those of you who know about elliptic curves as examples of projective group schemes, you know what E is, but I really don't want to mention the word group scheme again in this course. So E of K is simply the set of pairs x, y, where each of x and y is one of these elements of K. For instance, they can be integers mod 2 to the 255 minus 19. The set of pairs x and y, each in k, that satisfy y squared equals x cubed plus 486662 x squared plus x. And you figure for any particular pair x and y is about a 1 in 2 to the 255 chance of this happening. There should be about 2 to the 255 squared divided by 2 to the 255, about 2 to the 255 elements x, y of this curve. Certainly you can't write them all down. The exact number of points there, well, you can look it up in the curve 25519 paper. Along with, there's one extra element of this set E of K, namely infinity, which is not one of the pairs x and y. All right, so this is a set, first of all, and then it gets turned into a group by, there is a standard definition. Of an addition, an addition function from E of K times E of K. If you have two points, two elements of this set, then you get another one. And similarly, a definition of a minus operation, which is very easy to state. X, y has negative x, minus y, and a zero, which is the point at infinity. And these make E of K a group. In fact, it's important, it's not just a group, but a commutative group. The definition of plus is a little trickier to write down than the minus or zero, but basically, if you have three different points and they're on a line, then they add up to zero. And that pretty much characterizes the plus. And you can turn that, along with knowing what minus is, you can turn that into figuring out exactly what the group law does. In general, if you have a line and you look at the intersections with this curve, there could be fewer than three intersections. If there are three, then they all add up to zero in the group law. If there are fewer than three, then you have to say, okay, there must be a tangent or some other multiplicity, and in that case, you count the points with their multiplicity, which is what makes the plus look fairly complicated when you define it. But, all right, there is a definition, and I'm going to boil that down to some really cool formulas by Montgomery for computing plus in a better way than what the definition tells you, so I'm not going to repeat the definition here. This commutative group has a name. This is the K points of the elliptic curve E, which I still haven't defined, but in this quoted phrase, you just say E colon y squared equals x cubed plus 48666 to x squared plus x. All right, there's part of the definition. Now, what am I doing with this E of k? Well, am I up to defining curve 25519 yet? Not quite. I have to define some x-coordinate functions. And here, the details start looking a little bit tricky. If you want something that works and has no exceptional cases and you can do a clean mathematical analysis of it, you need to look at two different x-coordinate functions. So let me carefully define both of those. They're not complicated definitions, but if you want to prove things, I'm not going to run through the proofs in detail, but if you want to prove things, you need to be careful about this difference. Let's define x. This is a function that, given a point on the curve, gives you back its x-coordinate. And so is the other function I'm going to define. But first of all, x, what does it do with the point in infinity? It gives you infinity. So x has as input any point on E of k, and as output k or infinity. And, well, okay, the definition is that if you give it x comma y, little x comma little y, you get back little x. And if you give it infinity, you get infinity. Let me contrast this with something I'll call x sub 0, which is maybe a less obvious x-coordinate function, but it's what really works in this context. And this always gives you an element of k, and maps, as you might guess from the name, maps infinity to 0. To write that down, just in case you care about the definition for proving things rather than just believing what I say about, okay, these things all work. If you have a point x comma y, a pair x comma y, then you just write down the x-coordinate, and oops, that's supposed to be x sub 0, and x sub 0 of infinity equals 0. All right. X sub 0 is the right function for defining curve 25519, and now I can carefully do that. Suppose that you have a point on the curve, let me call it big Q, is an element of E of K. And suppose that its x-coordinate by the second function is in the base field, the prime field, Z mod 2 to the 255 minus 19. No square root of 2's here. So you just have, if the x-coordinate of Q is an integer between 0 and 2 to the 255 minus 20, then curve 25519 of, I have two inputs now. One of them is the exponent e, and the other one is x0 of Q. What I'm about to write is well defined. There's a unique function, curve 25519, that satisfies this equation for all the q's. And what is the equation? It is x0 of e times q, the eth multiple of q in the elliptic curve, on the elliptic curve. Maybe I should say just once, this is not the same as take the x and y coordinates of q and multiply each one by e. You have to use the group law for the elliptic curve here. All right, there is a unique function, curve 25519, that given an x-coordinate of q, any point on the curve, along with an exponent e, multiplies the point q by e and gives you the x-coordinate of the result. To see well-defined, you have to think, wait a minute, this could have been q or minus q. There's two points that have the same x-coordinate, and also be careful about infinity and zero. And then in all those cases, you check that, well, easily check that the eth multiple of plus or minus or infinity or zero gives you the same x0 as what you want. I mean, both of the points give you the same x0, so there is a unique function, curve 25519, that does satisfy this equation for every q. All right, I want to mention here a tweak, and then if I have a little time, I'll start on Montgomery's. I do have a little time. Good, so I'll start on Montgomery's formulas for x0. The tweak is to restrict e by a few bits, and one of those tweaks is, for example, insisting that e mod 8 is 0. And this is only marginally speeding things up, but it's more a security reminder for people that something that if you look at attacks, you see is that E mod 8 can be easily leaked to an attacker. It's very easy for an attacker to figure out E mod 4, and even E mod 8 in some situations the attacker can figure out. So just to avoid any questions about that, E mod 8 is required to be 0. And also there's some restriction on the range of E that it's it has a leading bit of 1 in its 255 possible bits. And I think at that point I've written down the complete list of restrictions on E. So, okay, the complete list, not just EG, is E mod 8 is 0, and E is between 2 to the 254 and 2 to the 255. Could be equal to 2 to the 254, less than 2 to the 255. So 4 bits of E are set to 0, the bottom 3 bits and the top 1 bit, assuming it's a 32-byte quantity. All right. So that's the definition of curve 25519. And then there's these, compared to typical elliptic curve formulas, amazingly simple formulas by Montgomery, Peter Montgomery, for computing multiples on elliptic curves that have this kind of shape. Well, x cubed plus something, x squared plus x is a very nice shape for computing x-coordinate multiples. And here, okay, the formulas, I remember a graphical formulation of them, but what I'm using here is a somewhat different mathematical formulation, so let me just recopy those to avoid mistakes. These are called Montgomery's two isogeny formulas. Just put that in quotes. That's the name for the formulas that I'm writing down here. People will often say Montgomery's recurrence, Montgomery's iteration, Montgomery addition, but whatever. These are Montgomery's formulas for computing doubles and sums of points on this elliptic curve and many other elliptic curves. Let's suppose we have a point on the curve, Q, and let's assume that 2Q is not infinity. Q is not infinity, and it's also not the point 0, 0, which you can check is has two times it being the point in infinity. When I say 2Q here, I mean in the elliptic curve group law, Q plus Q, according to the plus on the elliptic curve. Then I can write down here x of 2Q is exactly x of Q squared minus 1 squared divided by a non-zero quantity, namely 4 times x of Q cubed plus 486662, familiar number, x of Q squared plus x of Q. All right, if you know x of Q, you can square it, subtract 1, square the result. You can also square a qubit, multiply the square by 486662, add the cube and the original number, multiply that by 4, divide. I claim the denominator there is non-zero, and that is x of 2q. Furthermore, suppose you have some different points that you want to add instead of q plus q. Well, x of q plus r, and now I should have said here, r here is another point. If r and q are points on the curve, and I need to restrict a few other things, are not infinity, so q is not infinity, r has to be not infinity, and q is not equal to r, in other words, q minus r is not infinity, and q plus r is not infinity. And I guess I could just say q is not infinity for the second formulas, but okay, let's not stress too much about infinity. Then x of q plus r times x of q minus r is equal to the ratio between x of q, x of r minus 1, which looks kind of like the previous result, squared, but then the denominator is very different. The denominator is x of q minus x of r squared. It's easy to see from these formulas, if you ignore all the infinities that might show up, it's easy to see by induction that if x of q is number modulo 2 to the 255 minus 19, an element of the base prime field, if x0 of q, which is tantamount to x of q, is just an integer, 0 to 2 to the 255 minus 20, then all of the intermediate, all of the x of 2q, x of 3q, x of anything q is also going to be in the same field. Lots of ways to see the same thing, but well, the formulas just instantly tell you that. And in fact, you can compute very easily x of anything times q by plugging into these formulas. Did I have a letter for my multiple? N. X of nq. We're trying to get to any e times q, where e is under these restrictions, and along the way we'll figure out x of lots of numbers times q. And to simplify the discussion, let me just say for the moment, let's ignore for now the issues about infinity and x versus x0 and other things that can go wrong with the formulas and just focus on the typical case. Most q's are going to satisfy the following equations. Suppose we want, well, okay, the goal here is we're starting from x of q. You compute x of anything times q by Montgomery's recursion, which consists of plugging in appropriate q's into the formulas that I've written down. And what are those plugins? Well, let's take, instead of q in the first formula, let's try nq, x of 2nq is equal to x of nq squared minus 1 squared. Well, I'm just plugging in nq instead of q, and then the same denominator, which, okay, I won't bother recopying, with nq instead of q. How about if you want x of n, suppose you want x of 2n plus 1 times q. I'll think of 2n plus 1 times q as 2n plus 1 is n plus 1 plus n. So q plus r there, I'll substitute n plus 1 q for q, and I'll substitute nq for r. And what does that do for me? It says that x of 2n plus 1 q, 2nq plus q, this is, okay, this is not my q and r. R is not q, r is nq here. And that tells me that on the top I have x of q is nq plus q substituted, and r is nq subtract 1 square, divide by the difference between those x's I just wrote down, x of nq plus q minus x of nq squared, and oops, I forgot one piece, which was x of q minus r. Q is changing to n plus 1q, and r is changing to nq, so their difference is something I know, namely x of q. And then you continue in this way if you actually want 2nq plus 2q. Well, it's just another case of the 2nq recursion. This is x of nq plus q squared minus 1 squared divided by the same denominator with n plus 1q. And okay, these two formulas cover every possible case for x of anything times q in terms of much smaller multiples of q. Looking at these formulas, suppose that you want x of something times q. Let's focus on at the end of the day, you get x of, say, eq, along with, basically for free, x of eq plus q if you want it. And where are those in this recursion? Well, it depends on whether e is even or odd. You either have e is 2n for some n, in which case you're in the first case, and actually with the restrictions on e, it's always in that case. But I'm going to use this recursively, which tells me maybe I shouldn't have my e again. Sorry for the notational changes. What did I do on my notes for this? Oh, I did use e. Well, all right. Anyway, if you have, let's do one last substitution. If you want x of nq and x of nq plus q, then you get those from dividing n in half. You get x of q and x of the floor of n over 2 q and x of the floor of n over 2 plus 1 q using, well, either the first two of the three formulas I've written down here or the second two. If n is even, then n and n plus 1 are cases of the first two parts of this recursion. in terms of half of them. And if n is odd, then you get the something plus 1, even plus 1, and even plus 2 cases of the recursion. And in any case, these come from these three smaller quantities. We know x of q, and then you get these n over 2 and n over 2 plus 1 recursively in the same way. Using how many operations? Well, the critical operations are the divisions here, using two divisions and some number of multiplications and some additions, subtractions. Well, I won't count those precisely. I guess several multiplications. You could count them if you want, but we'll be doing better by getting rid of the divisions to speed this up. Anyway, for the moment, these formulas involve two divisions, several multiplications. If you do that all the way from E down to 0, if you have a 255-bit E, you get from X of Q to X of EQ using, well, there's 255 of these halvings, and overall something like 510, I might be off by one for the getting X of 2Q, but basically 510 divisions and whatever number of multiplications. And then assuming that X of Q is no square root of 2 is involved, assuming that X of Q is an integer mod 2 to the 255 minus 19, then all of the multiplications and divisions you do and subtractions stay inside this field. You never have to think about the square root of 2. It's convenient for the definition, without which I would have lost half of the curve 25519 inputs. You need to have some reasonably close to algebraically closed K, well, something with square roots of the base field elements in it, that guarantees that for every x-coordinate there is a y-coordinate, for every x-coordinate in here. Anyway, you don't have to use the square root of 2's for the computation. If X of Q starts as an integer, which it always does in curve 25519, then all of these divisions and multiplications and the additions and subtractions are divisions, multiplications, and additions in this field. These are operations on integers mod a prime, the kind of thing that we have lots of practice doing. Bigger computation, I haven't talked at all about how to do divisions, and, well, I don't really want to do divisions. I'll talk about that, I guess I'm out of time for now, but start of next time, I'll jump back into these formulas and optimize them, getting rid of basically all the divisions and trying to get rid of multiplications, and we'll see that Montgomery's formulas, Montgomery did all the optimization too, Montgomery's formulas end up being only about 10 times slower than doing an East power modulo 2 to the 255 minus 19. And then say something about the low levels of the software, then consider alternatives, and then I'll be up to RSA. So I will see everybody tomorrow at, actually before I say that, any quick questions, let's say 10 second questions. All right, if there are questions, then come see me afterwards. Otherwise, I'll see everybody tomorrow at 11 o'clock.